When she was 18, her father gave her the advice she needed to follow her dreams and become a writer. The next day, he had a heart attack and died in her arms. She did become a writer and a business owner and then a wife and mother. Today, after 13 books, a million of them in print, she's an award-winning syndicated columnist, a radio and TV host, and the owner of two successful companies. And now, Elise is here to help you rebuild your life. Stay tuned. This is gonna be good. This is the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Glink Show. So glad to have you here this morning. 404-872-0750, and you can also join the conversation online, thinkglink.com, or on Twitter, at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K. Lindsay Biegza joins me today. She's the chief economist for Sternege. They are in the research and economic trends business. They look at the analysis of the economy, what's going on in the world, financial markets, fiscal policies, a lot of the stuff that we talk about every week. And I've been a big follower of her work for a while, and I thought it would be interesting to have her come on so we could have a conversation about where home prices are, what are some of the latest housing trends that she's seeing, and where interest rates are going over the next few weeks. Lindsay, welcome to the Elise Glink Show.
Great. Thanks for having me.
So what's going on with the housing market? It seems to me that we're getting very conflicting messages. I look at the total number of new homes sold. It's really about half or less than half of where it should be. Existing home sales, not really where they should be either, although they're doing a little bit better, I think mostly propped up by what hedge funds and private equity groups are doing. But where do you see housing trends?
Well, you know, we are seeing a lot of conflicting reports in the housing market, and that's not necessarily a negative thing. I think that we would expect that in the early stages of the recovery, and I think we are still very early in the stages of recovery. We're starting to see demand move back into the marketplace. We have seen an upward trajectory in home sales activity for quite a while now, but as of late, that has gotten very volatile, with a pullback during the spring season, which should be the height of the year's activity.
Right. So let me jump in there and say June was outrageously disappointing, right? 34,000 new homes sold, roughly. It was down 11.5% from May. And April and May looked pretty good at, I think it was 40 and 49,000, respectively, for new homes sold. Those were okay numbers and doing a little bit better than we'd seen over the last bunch of years. And then June, what happened there?
Well, you know, I think part of it was when we moved into the first quarter of the year, there were a lot of home buyers sitting on the sidelines waiting for that warmer weather. As we know, housing is one of the most weather-sensitive sectors of the economy. For some reason, home buyers don't like to go out and shop for a home during storms or winter weather.
Can't really blame them.
Exactly. So they were sidelined for a while. Then that nicer weather moved in April and May, and I think that shoehorned forward a lot of demand that had been sitting on the sidelines, meaning that we saw above the expected level in those 2 months, but then by the time June came around, demand began to fall off.
So what does that really say about the underlying demand trend?
Well, I think what that says is it's very very sensitive right now. And I think this is a good segue into the price discussion. Prices right now are very elevated, and that is squeezing out a lot of demand. So we have a diminished pool of demand trying to enter into the marketplace. And, of course, getting a mortgage isn't as easy as it once was.
All right, so let's talk about that, because prices are higher. They haven't quite gotten back to the peak that they were at 2005 and 2006. And when we look at median home prices, for example, they have gone up a lot, but that could also be explained by the super low-end stuff just coming out of the marketplace entirely. And so you're seeing maybe the higher-end stuff propping it up. You know, how does that balance out when you take a deeper look at the numbers?
No, I certainly agree with you that there is a lot of bifurcation in the market. But still, when we look at the aggregate, I think the average homebuyer coming into the marketplace, even though prices haven't returned to their peak, they're under more pressure now because income has fallen so dramatically. Remember, a few years back, income was growing at a 7, 8% pace. We've now slowed that to just about 3.5%. So income growth is not keeping up with home price appreciation. So the average consumer trying to make that purchase, trying to put that 20% down, they're struggling to do so.
So is this why the Fed, or one reason why the Fed continues to keep interest rates near zero. They keep stretching out that time. They are pulling back on the mortgage securities that they're buying. So mortgage-backed securities, they've been buying those and other kinds of securities for the last, I don't know how many years, we're in QE3 or 4, I think. But they are pulling back, and the expectation was that interest rates would go up, and they haven't been. And one of the things I've been saying on the show is that they aren't, because they're truly reflective, unlike the stock market, of where the economy actually is. What do you think about that?
I think you hit the nail right on the head. The Fed, although they are beginning to wind down that quantitative easing program, or as you mentioned, that outright buying program of both MBS and longer-term treasury securities, is because they no longer believe that that's benefiting the economy. But that does not mean that the Fed is ready to raise rates. And they've been very clear that they are committed to accommodation for a, quote, extended period of time, even beyond when quantitative easing ends. And you're right. Part of that is targeted, or I should say reflective, of the fact that fundamentals in the economy are still very weak. And I think Yellen was very clear in her latest comments, noting that despite the fact the economy is growing at 2%, despite the fact that we're seeing plus 200,000 in terms of headline employment growth, that is not translating into fundamental growth or translating into wage pressures, which would benefit the consumer, which would then make it easier for them to go out and make large purchases, such as buying a home.
Yeah, I think there's, I hear it over and over again from our callers that they are, and this is Atlanta. So granted, Atlanta, the entire state of Michigan and parts of, you know, Nevada, Arizona, New Mexico are still doing worse, Illinois, than other parts of the country. But people really don't have jobs that are paying what they were paying. We have people who have gotten new jobs, but they're maybe part-time versus full-time, right? Or they are earning maybe half or a third less than they were earning before, so they don't feel they're employed, but they don't actually feel empowered financially.
Right, that's part of the problem. If the average person hears about the unemployment rate dropping down to 6% or 6.2, but it's very easy to get the unemployment rate down if nobody's looking for a job. So part of the problem too is that we have millions of Americans dropping out of the labor force, saying right now conditions are so bad I'm not going to bother looking for a job. And those that still are in the labor force and lucky enough to find employment, as you mentioned, the vast majority of job creation has been part-time. In fact, nearly 60% of the jobs created since the end of the recession have been part-time. 16% have been temporary, and nearly 50% have been low-wage. So again, that's not indicative of that high-wage career development that you would expect nearly 6 years into the recovery.
So it's interesting. I saw a story in the New York Times recently where it talked about how coding has become commoditized to a certain degree, where you don't even need to go to college. It's more like a trade than anything else. And if you learn how to code, you're guaranteed a pretty decent job at a really decent wage, and the demand for that is growing. There's a million jobs unfilled, maybe even more right now in the U.S. for coders, people who can actually program computers. And there's a saying in Silicon Valley that you're either going to be the ones who code, or you're going to live and die by the ones what they do code. So, you know, when you look at something like that, at jobs that we, even without a college degree, but with maybe 12 or 15 weeks of training, could pay people $60,000, $80,000, $100,000 a year, is that something that pouring money into those kinds of programs, getting more people in, more women in, is that going to be something that helps solve the housing crisis?
You know, I really think this is an interesting point, because when we look at the labor market, there is a huge skills mismatch. Right now, there are a tremendous number of vacancies, as you mentioned, for coding, but it goes beyond that. It's IT, engineering, craft labor, accounting. And unfortunately, we're turning out all of these millions of students out of college with degrees that don't necessarily fill the job vacancies in today's workforce. And so I think we're going to have to change the mindset that people may benefit more by going to a two-year trade school. Look, you come out of trade school with zero in terms of debt. Your starting salary as an engineer down in Texas, maybe in the energy sector, is maybe $100,000. And versus coming out of college with $30,000 or $40,000 in debt, struggling to find an entry-level position, but still years behind in terms of strapped with that enormous amount of college debt. So I think we do have to go through a shift in psychology that not everyone may benefit from a college degree.
Yeah, it's interesting, because we really are seeing It must be another revolution, right? We had the Industrial Revolution. We've had the, you know, as we've gone through. But I think we're at this digital revolution is now coming to a head. And unlike some of the other revolutions we've seen for labor workforce, I think that this one is actually happening at a much faster pace. And it's caught a lot of people unawares. Or maybe I didn't live through the others, so maybe it was always like that.
No, I think you're right. I think it's a shift in psychology, too. And bringing it back to the housing market, I think this will have an impact two ways. One, the psychology of the younger generation is very much changing. So we don't have the 20-something graduating out of college and running to buy that first-time single-family home. So right there, we're depleting the future demand rolling into the labor market, excuse me, the housing market. The second issue is that if we do have those younger generations looking to make that home purchase, again, as I mentioned, coming out of college with $30,000 or $40,000 in debt, you were averaging a 3% savings rate. That means it's going to take 10 or 15 years of maybe living in mom and dad's basement before they have that 20% payment to make that home purchase. So again, really a disruptive, cyclical factor here for the housing market.
Where do you see us going? We just have a couple of minutes left, but where do you see us going over the next 5 years? I mean, the stock market is just seems completely disconnected from reality, but maybe that's just me. I mean, what are you seeing?
You know, it certainly is. But remember, you can create stockholder wealth or shareholder wealth without growing the fundamentals in the economy. And I think that's where the disconnect is really coming. Now, in terms of my outlook for the next 5 years, I do see the economy slowly gaining momentum, but tapping out at a much lower bar. So I think that we would sit here in this 2-2.5% GDP range for at least the next 2 or 3 years, then slowly maybe working out some of these excesses in terms of the household balance sheet and getting up to that 2.5-3% pace. But that's a very optimistic view. I think that's the best case scenario. Unfortunately, we do have just an average of 2% GDP with an extraordinary number of years of accommodation from the Federal Reserve. So one of the biggest problems that we face is unrolling that accommodation with the fundamentals in the economy still very much systemically weak.
Oh, not a great report. I'm sorry, Lindsay.
I really wish I could be more optimistic at this point, but we still have a tremendous number of barriers to overcome.
Yeah, I think that's really true. Lindsay Piegza is the chief economist for Sternegy. Thank you so much for being with us today. Can people find you on Twitter, Lindsay Piegza, and we'll link to you. Is there anywhere else you'd like people to go?
I think those are the best places to find me. I appreciate the time. Thank you so much for having me on.
Sounds good, Lindsay. Stay tuned, everybody. We'll be back in a moment with more of the Elise Kling Show, Rebuilding America, One House at a Time, starting with yours on WSB.
News 95.5 and AM 750, WSB.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Kling Show, Rebuilding America, One House at a Time, starting with yours on WSB. So I wanted to give you Lindsay's information again. You can find her on Twitter, Lindsay Piegza, LindsayPiegza, and I will, well, if you go to Twitter right now, at Glink, you will be seeing me tweet to her, but we will also put up all the information at the thinklink.com blog, so you'll be able to see some of her work and then have links to some of the other things that she does. She also writes for, I think it's Forbes, maybe, a lot of different places, and she's published at the Harvard Business School Review as well. So one of the things I do want to highlight that she said that, you hear me say week in and week out on this show is that things are not as they seem, right? So when you look at what's going on between the Fed pulling back on the mortgage-backed security purchases but not actually increasing the interest rates, that tells you, as I keep saying, every single thing you need to know about the economy. Until you start to see interest rates rise, you know that we're still in the doghouse. And if you look at what we're paying for mortgages right now, this week alone, the mortgage interest rate is nearly at the 50-year low again. It's somewhere around 4% for a 30-year fixed. People are getting 15 years at under 3.25%. And if you're willing to pay a point, it's even less than that. So when you're still getting interest rates like that, when everybody in the world expected it to be over 5% by now, it tells you that things aren't as good as people would want you to believe. It's just not there yet. We are making some progress. We are seeing the mismatch that Lindsay talked about in the labor market. So we're seeing more jobs created, which sounds awfully good, but there's about 10 million people who have just, over the last 7-8 years, thrown up their hands, walked away entirely, and are not even counted among the missing when it comes to getting a job. All right, stay tuned. When we come back, we're going to talk about a company called Doorsteps. And the founder of Doorsteps, a woman named Michelle Otero, is going to join us online on the Elise Glink Show. So stay tuned for that. I'm Elise Glink, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB.
News 95.5 and AM 750, WSB.
Hey, welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB. Don't forget to join the conversation on Twitter at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K. Michelle Otero joins me on the line. She is the founder of a company called Doorsteps. Doorsteps is a service that helps people make smarter home buying decisions. Like so many things that you're seeing out there right now, it's lead generation. Michelle, welcome to the Elise Glink Show.
Thank you so much.
So I understand that you are a former opera singer. Is that right?
I am, correct.
I think you're the first opera singer we've ever had on this show. And if I'd had a little bit of notice on that, I might have asked you to sing a few notes. So what made you decide to leave that and move into design and innovation and then moving into home buying? How did that all happen?
Sure. So I grew up singing. I went to the Juilliard School, and then I went to Indiana University to study music. So always had a passion for music, and opera specifically. After I graduated with my master's, I felt like there were other things that I was interested in doing. So, make a very long story short, I entered the world of design. And so I became a design consultant at a company called IDEO. It's a global design and innovation firm. And it was at IDEO that I really understood and saw the power that design could have in helping people go through journey-based life experiences, like having a baby, sending a child to college.
Mm-hmm.
So it was there that I really saw the power of design. And then several years later, I was purchasing my first home in New York City.
Oh, gosh. Well, the fact that you bought a home in New York City already puts you way far ahead.
Yeah, but you know what's really interesting is I felt very, very confident that I was actually at the place that I could do that. Unfortunately, the process of buying was a really tough one. New York, as you know, is a very sort of tough, extreme market.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in that moment where I took the learnings from IDEO and said to myself, there has to be a better way to take people through this process, especially when they're very early on and they're just curious.
Mm-hmm. So it's too bad you didn't run into my book, 100 Questions Every First-Time Homebuyer Should Ask.
Yeah.
Might have made your life a little easier.
Yeah, no, it's really interesting. You know, I think that, you know, there's so much information out there and it's so valuable. What I've found is that, you know, as you know, the web is there 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, and there's some interesting things that you can do with these step-based processes online mm-hmm. that can really help that go, you know, really smoothly. Or at least try.
So it was from
that experience that I ended up founding Doorsteps.
So what does Doorsteps do?
So Doorsteps is an interactive guide to buying a home. What we're really trying to do is take somebody who is curious about buying a home, and this is maybe somebody who is renting today, that potentially is 18 to 24 months out. We want to help that person who is curious. We want to give them a soft place to land. We want to teach them and give them the tools that they need to become more confident. And if they so choose buying a home, if they think it's the right thing for them to do, we want to help them become more committed. So really we're a journey-based experience online today.
And you spent 2 years building this and then Move.com, which is paired with realtors,
yes.
bought you.
Yes. So we were, as you mentioned, we were pretty early stage. We bootstrapped from the start. We got very lucky, and we signed a contract. We had an initial prototype. We signed a contract with a major bank that helped funded our first year of growth. So we went straight into having paying customers, which I think is the best way to go for an entrepreneur, but sometimes a hard way to go. Mm-hmm. And I think that we were in the next phase was either raising money so that we could grow adequately for where we needed to be, or do a potentially more strategic engagements with this bank. But we actually were approached by Move, owner and operator of Realtor.com, and at the time, given where the team was and where I was, we felt like it was the right move for us. And really, the team is trying to create as much impact as we possibly can in housing. And the partnership with Realtor.com and Move, we felt like, was really going to enable us to sort of take us to the next level.
So who finds you? Who finds you, and how many people have gone through your program?
How many people have gone through Dorsets?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, so I would say from the beginning, we've helped several hundred thousand first-time home buyers go through the process.
And do you have any sense of how many of those people, once they've gone through this, understand enough to buy a house and have actually bought?
We've heard, because, you know, as you know, that process could sometimes take a very long time. So as I mentioned, we're really trying to speak to the early stage home buyer, mm-hmm. The person who is potentially 18 to 24 months out. So for us, that was sort of a long lead time from when someone maybe would first start using our service to when they closed on the house. So mm-hmm. I would say over the past year, we've been hearing about a lot of people who have learned about the process and actually bought a home as well. So we hear those stories trickle in of how the tool really helped to humanize some of the process that was just very difficult for them to understand.
So building a business which is successfully purchased by an even bigger business, a publicly traded business, is a very difficult thing to do. And especially, I love that you've had this sort of creative training background, because there's this disconnect that only people who've been to business school can actually start businesses. And in fact, you know, starting a business and having an idea for something that's design-based or creatively inspired, but then having enough common sense, which I actually think most business is very common sense-oriented, having enough common sense to actually pull that through to a successful sale is something that I think a lot of our listeners are trying to do and thinking about mm-hmm. doing. What tips do you have for them as an entrepreneur, a successful entrepreneur, on starting, building, selling a business?
Yeah, so I think, you know, specific, you know, and this doesn't necessarily have to be specific to real estate. I have one that maybe is general, and one that is maybe a little bit more specific to these very systemic challenges like healthcare and financial services, education. I think the first one is don't be afraid to have a bold vision.
Mm-hmm.
But have the discipline to break that vision down into sort of component pieces. So when we first started Dorsets, we were only able to bite off one or two pieces of the journey that we had planned and had hoped for. But really what was it was important to have that bold vision so we knew where we were headed. So in our minds, we knew that in 5 years, the impact we wanted to have on the world and the impact we wanted to have on people and businesses. But we had the discipline to know that vision was a 5-year vision. So to break that down into a small part so that you can test that today. So I think that, you know, my suggestion to anyone, I don't have a technical background. You know, I was an opera singer. I have a design background. I'm savvy in business, but I didn't have the technical skills. But I tried not to let that hold me back. I tried to figure out how I could prototype and learn and test my idea with people very early and very often in a way that was appropriate for me. So I could do a sketch, I could write out a narrative about what my idea was, and then show that to people. So that would be my suggestion to people, to not let your lack of technical skills, especially in the online world, stand in the way of you actually testing your business.
It sounds like you have to really believe in yourself as well. I mean, you had a concept that this could be easier for people.
Yeah, I really, and you'll hear a lot of founders, I think, talk this way. I really believe that there still is a problem to be solved. That this, specifically in housing, there's pain points that people are still feeling today. Mm-hmm. And so I was really passionate about being able to figure out, identifying what those friction points are, and then figuring out new and better ways to address them.
So you talk now like you have an MBA. You do know that, right? You don't talk like an opera singer anymore.
Yes.
Well, the friction pain points and blah, blah, blah. I mean, it's good because you're able to communicate with the people who fund you, but it's funny to listen to somebody who I know when you went through your opera training, friction was probably not a word that you used.
That's a great point. That's a great point. Yeah, I would say probably, to be honest with you, the past 2.5 years have actually been an MBA.
I'll bet.
So to speak. And I think the last one, just specifically in these very difficult categories like financial services or healthcare or education, you know, the ones in which I find that people need the most help but come with the most sort of regulatory issues or constraints. My suggestion is to embrace the constraints. I think that when we first started this business, we're very idealistic, and we wanted to ignore all of the stakeholders that were very much so very part of the process, whether they be loan officers or real estate agents. But I think we soon realized that in a perfect world, it's how do you get the stakeholders to work better together. And mm-hmm. So my suggestion in these really difficult categories that I feel like need the most help, to embrace those constraints and really figure out how you can design with them in mind.
So what would you say is your biggest mistake that you made as an entrepreneur building this business so far? Or give me a couple of them.
I would say that the first one was the first tip that I had. I think that I was very idealistic in that what I could build. So I had a very big vision, but I was naive, and I didn't understand how long this sometimes takes. from a technology perspective. And right. So I think that was one of the mistakes that one of the biggest mistakes that I made is not really breaking down my big vision into small enough chunks. And I don't know. I think some of the mistakes that I feel like I might say today were things that were assets at the time. I think that when I was talking to people, I really got them excited about maybe something we hadn't built today, but that mm-hmm. we could build in the future.
Right.
So that might have been a mistake at the moment when we realized that we had to scramble to build something tomorrow. But I was very convincing to people, and I think at the time that might have come across as a mistake. But I think in the end it really served us, because that got people excited about what we were trying to do.
But that's communicating the big vision that you had, maybe not
exactly
quite the timeline. But I think any
correct
entrepreneur who actually thinks about how long it'll really take, and if you're really honest, you'd never do it, because
correct
it's like, oh, what's the point of banging my head against the wall for 5 years? And 5 years,
yes,
just no matter how old you are, 5 years seems like a really significant amount of time. And if you're in your 40s or 50s and doing it, it's like, oh my God, I'll be nearly ready for retiring. And if I'm in my 20s, 5 years just seems like a quarter of your life. So why would you spend that? So I think that just would only serve to, I don't know, dent the enthusiasm, shall we say,
right,
and make
correct
it a little bit harder, which is so interesting. Well, when we come back, can you stay with me for a minute? Because I'd like to come back and ask you about the thing that you think you did the best. And for an entrepreneur, I think there's a lot of lessons in that. If you're just yep tuning in, we're listening to Michelle Cerro. She's the founder of a website called doorsteps.com, which she started up to make the home buying process a whole lot easier. And we'll talk to her in just a minute. I'm Elise Glink, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB.
News 95.5 and AM 750 WSB.
Hey, welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB. Michelle Cerro is on the phone with me right now. She's the founder of a company called Doorsteps. You can find them at doorsteps.com. She bootstrapped it, built it up, made an easier way for people to understand the journey of homeownership, and then sold it to move.com, but she's still working on it. So, Michelle, what would you say is the very best thing that you did with Doorsteps, and what is the advice that you would give entrepreneurs who are listening to the show today?
Sure. So I think the best thing that I've done throughout the process is to really build a great team. And if I've learned anything throughout this process from start to finish, it's that the people that you surround yourself with when you are building something new is so important. And because the idea might shift and might change, but it's really the people that are going to stay there. And so to really figure out how to motivate and bring together really smart people. And I say this often, and you hear this a lot. I really try to hire people who are much better than I am at what they do, at what I do. And because I'm always trying to to learn as well. So I think that the most important thing is really making sure that you're surrounding yourself with people you not only trust, but also are inspired by, because this business will occupy a lot of your time, a lot of your headspace, and I think it's really important to make sure that the people that you're surrounding yourself with are the people you want to see day in and day out, because they will become your everything.
Oh.
And so I think the team is very much so a big part of that.
Yeah, I agree. If you don't have people you want to spend time with and can laugh with and cry with, it's just never going to work. Michelle Cerro is the founder of Doorsteps. You can find them online at doorsteps.com. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
All right, stay tuned. I'm Elise Glink, Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours. We'll be back in a moment with more on WSJ.
News 95.5 and AM 750, WSB.
Hey, welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Glink Show, Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB, online all the time at thinklink.com, and follow me on Twitter at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K. At the thinklink.com blog, we're going to have links to everybody we've been talking to today. I want you to be able to call them, email them, phone them. Well, nobody phones anymore, but I want you to be able to connect, learn, grow, be smarter about what you're doing, always. Brandon Turner is joining me now. He's the Vice President of Marketing Communications, and he told me he was like employee number one of a company called BiggerPockets.com. And BiggerPockets is a website where people who are interested in investing in real estate, something we talk about all the time on this show, can learn from each other, join a forum, connect, communicate. He just told me that they have pro memberships, which I didn't even realize. Brandon, welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
So tell me how you got started in real estate, because I assume that's where this all began for you.
Yeah, sure, no problem. So I bought a house. I didn't know what I was doing, obviously. Nobody really does when they're starting out. And bought myself a single-family house, fixed it up a little bit. I was raised by a garage sale mom, mm-hmm. So, of course, I knew to buy something cheap and try to get a good deal. So I did that and ended up selling it pretty quickly. And made a small profit, I think, you know, $20,000 or something like that. And I thought, you know, that was a lot of fun. I could actually do that for a living. And so I decided to get into house flipping, which trying to flip houses when the market's just crashing, you know, back in 2007, 2008, not always the best idea. So
where are you based? Are you based?
I'm in Seattle. Well, outside Seattle. Of Seattle, an hour and a half.
Okay.
So right on the coast.
Mm-hmm. And, that must be nice.
Yeah, it's beautiful out here. I mean, it's gorgeous. If you're familiar with Twilight, that's where I live. It's right where Twilight was. The movie took place.
Nice.
So right out in the rainforest area.
Okay.
So gorgeous area.
But the market was crashing, and so flipping houses
yep.
got a little harder.
Yes, flipping houses got very tough. As I finished one up, and then you couldn't chase the market low enough. You couldn't drop your price low enough to try to catch it. And nobody was buying. Nobody could qualify. So I had the bright idea to rent out the property.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I started as a real estate investor,
okay.
More than just a flipper.
All right. And so how did you connect with the BiggerPockets.com guys?
Sure. That's actually kind of a funny story. This is back in 2000, and I think early 2008, and I had decided to rent that property out. So I called my dad, actually, and I said, hey, Dad, I know I was going to go to law school. That was going to be my plan. And I had actually taken the LSAT and everything. And then I said, you know what? I'm going to scratch all that. I want to be a real estate investor. And he thought I was crazy. He flat out told me the words, if you do that, your tenants are not going to pay rent. You're going to go broke. You're going to be homeless, and you're going to go bankrupt, and your life's going to be miserable.
Okay.
I mean, that was
let's just talk about parents not supporting their kids. What was? I mean, I know he had your best interests in mind, and. I guess you could have always said, but Dad, I'm saving you $150,000 or that it's $150,000
yeah.
I won't be paying in tuition that I'll never use. But, okay, so you had this little tussle with your dad. Then what happened?
Yeah, so I was like, you know, after he told me that, I'm like, oh, man, you're right. Like, I can't afford this if tenants don't pay. And so I went online that night and typed into, I think it was Google, might have been back in the days of Dogpile or, you know, Yahoo, and typed in what to do when tenants don't pay. And the site BiggerPockets came up and was, I think probably the couple years they'd been around, it was very, very small at that time. And what I discovered that day was that there were answers. You know, there were answers to all those questions that everyone says, like, oh, I know, you know, my uncle rented out properties and it was terrible for him. And, you know, everyone's got a story of an uncle or an aunt who rented out properties and it was terrible and they lost money.
Right.
And what I realized, yeah, there were actually people who were successful at doing it that weren't selling it for, you know, $40,000 and, you know, come to the back of the room and we'll hook you up with the next $40,000 coaching plan. Like, there were actually people out there sharing what they knew, and there's a community being built. So that's when I jumped on Bigger Pockets that day.
All right. So you jumped on Bigger Pockets, and then how did it come? Were you just so active on the site that they said, wait, we ought to hire you?
sort of. I mean, I was fairly active. I mean, not as much, obviously, as I am today. But it became, I started blogging. I started doing more and more real estate. I'm kind of, you know, the poster child for Bigger Pockets success in that, I mean, I'm not wildly successful today, but I got a good number of rental properties and enough that I could quit my job and I was, you know, so to speak, retired at 27 years old, where I didn't have to work anymore. The rental properties paid for it. So I thought, well, what do I do next? You know, do I just keep building this? And I thought, well, maybe I'll start writing. So I started writing and blogging online, and I started volunteering for Bigger Pockets to write articles. And one day they posted that they were considering hiring their very first person to help kind of run the blog. And I thought, well, that sounds pretty fun. That's something I'm doing anyway. And that's when I reached out to Josh Dork, and we are friends anyway for a while. And I don't really know how it came about. We had five conversations, each one about an hour long. And somehow by the end of it, I was full-time working for Bigger Pockets and never really could pinpoint an exact moment where I was offered a job. But it just
So your dad, did he apologize?
He still tells me every time I see him. Every time I see him, it's, you know, you could have been a lawyer by now, or you could be, you know, an engineer. And I always remind him that I'd be working 90 hours a week in an office somewhere, you know, miserable. But right now I'm doing two things that I love. I'm real estate investing and I'm writing. And I can't ask for anything better than that. So he gives me a hard time about it, but he understands.
So you can just tell him from me that there are a whole lot of lawyers who have graduated from law school recently and don't have jobs. So it could be worse. You could be having $150,000, $180,000 in debt, and you could be unemployed.
That's exactly it. And I think, yes, you know, some people are just, I think, stuck in that. I mean, he understands it now, but I think some people just get stuck in that older mentality of if you go to school, if you go to college, if you go to law school, you will get this job, and that company will take care of you for the next 50 years, and you'll retire wealthy. And it's that mindset that I think has changed in the past 20 years with my generation, especially, like, the idea that you can kind of choose yourself to make a living. You don't have to rely on a company.
So let's talk a little bit more about Bigger Pockets and some of the advice. You told me before we went on the air that you're almost at 1 million posts on the forum. Is that what you said?
Correct, yeah, a million
wow.
Forum posts. I think we're at 940,000 right now or something like that. And those are just people asking questions or answering them.
So when you have something like that, what are some of the mistakes that people talk about? What is the advice? Do you see people giving only good advice? Do they give bad advice? Is there no such thing as bad advice anymore? What are you seeing?
Sure. What I find is perspective. Everything's about perspective. There's very, very few black and white answers in real estate. I'm sure you're familiar with. I mean, everything's kind of like yes, but, or no, but, in that, you know, people might ask the question, a lot of people ask questions, how do I get started? I have no money. How do I get started with no money?
Mm-hmm.
And so you'll get perspectives from all sorts of people some people will say you should not get started. I mean, you get people who are more, you know, conservative, saying, you know, save up the money, buy the property in cash, get a good job. And then you get people on the other end who are saying, yeah, here's some creative methods for getting started with no money whatsoever. And so you get a whole variety, which I think that's the power, more than anything, that's the power of Bigger Pockets, is that you don't get this is the answer. I mean, you buy a book. I love books. I read a lot of books. But you get a book and it says, this is what you should do.
Right.
A, B, and C. And, but life is never that simple, right? Life is much more about perspective, and it's different for everyone. And that's kind of where the forum comes in really handy.
That sounds great. When you are looking out at what people are saying are the biggest mistakes that they're making, or that other people are saying don't make these mistakes, what are some of the things that, and maybe even from your own experience as an investor, I know I've got, you know, rental properties.
Yep.
I've made all kinds of mistakes. If you read my books, they're littered with my mistakes. I think this is why people buy them, to see all the mistakes that I have made. But what are the mistakes you're seeing people make?
Sure, yeah, and I have no problem talking about mine. I've made so many. And the mistakes, what's kind of fun is the mistakes that I've made are the same ones that people are making all the time. So, you know, there's nothing really new in this. It's people tend to make the same ones. And those are, I mean, things I noticed is renting to family and friends. I've made that mistake over and over and over, and I've gotten in trouble for it over and over and over.
Wait a second. So I can understand you making the mistake once, but over and over and over again?
Over
really?
And over. Yep.
You seem like a smarter guy than that.
I must have done it. I, you know, a soft spot for these, you know, buddies who are like, hey, you know, I just lost my house. What do I do? Where can I get a place? I'm like, oh, you know, here, crash here for a few weeks. I got a vacancy. Yeah, it's always a terrible idea, always. It always ends up one of two possibilities. Number one is I either have to, I have to give in and lose a lot of money, or I lose the relationship. It never really ends, you know, other than that. I either lose money or I lose the relationship. And so I generally lost the money, and you know, I chose to salvage the relationships, but never again. So that's a mistake people make all the time, and I'm always telling people, don't rent to family or friends. Even if you think it's a good idea, don't do it. Secondly, another huge mistake people make is not analyzing properties. I mean, too many people look at a property. I mean, I went to look at one this morning. I thought it looked amazing. And when I got there and I actually ran the numbers, sat down with a pencil and paper and ran the numbers, and it turned out being a terrible deal. And if I would have bought it without doing the numbers, I would have been probably upside down on it or been losing money every month.
Do you have a strategy for properties that, you know, when you say you run the numbers, what is it you're looking for? The algorithm is what I think a crazy tech investor would say, but what are the numbers that you're looking for?
Sure. So when I'm looking at a property, there's a lot of different ways you can build wealth in real estate, but primarily the two ways, right, are cash flow and appreciation. So cash flow is the money that comes in every month, the extra money after all the expenses have been paid, and appreciation is when prices go up and you can, you know, eventually sell it. So I'm a cash flow investor. I mean, appreciation is great. When property values go up, great, but that's not what I look for. I look for cash flow personally just because I like the extra money every month. And as such, I want to make sure that I calculate all the expenses. And this is a mistake people make. They look at a property and say, okay, great. You know, it'll rent for $1,000 a month, and the mortgage and the insurance and taxes are only going to be $800. So great, I'm going to make $200 a month. But they forget about all those little things like, you know, the nuisances like repairs and vacancies and a tenant's stupid and they light the wall on fire because they're smoking outside. I mean, those things happen all the time. And if you don't budget for them, you don't plan for that, you're going to end up year after year losing money on an investment that's not really an investment. It's just a liability.
Which is really crazy. And you never want to lose that kind of money, right? It's too hard to
never
make.
Do.
It's what I always say to people. You spend so much of your life working so hard for the money that you have, and then if you're not careful about it, look what happens to it. It's crazy.
Yep. It's gone. It's sad, and I see it. You know what drives me, maybe not crazy, but just makes me sad, is the number of properties that I've bought in my life and that have been foreclosures from landlords. You know, I buy a lot of small multifamilies. That's kind of my niche that I like. Mm-hmm. So I buy a lot of properties that are, you know, duplexes, triplexes, and fourplexes, and almost all of them have been foreclosures. And I know that a landlord had them, and a landlord lost them. And I look at what they paid for them. And, you know, I bought a triplex a short while ago for $70,000, and had it was a foreclosure, but the owner had paid $170,000 for it. And there's no way it would make sense at $170,000. So it just kind of, you know, breaks my heart to see how many people just, they read a book on landlording or on investing in real estate, or they read a blog post, and they think they're just going to jump into it and be successful. But
right. They don't actually.
They don't get it.
I'm talking with Brandon Turner. He's Vice President of Marketing and Communications for a website called BiggerPockets.com, which is a place that people go to talk about their investments. They're investing in real estate. And for those of you who have bought my series, The Intentional Investor, How to Be Wildly Successful in Real Estate, Brandon is saying something super important, which is you've got to look at your numbers. All right, Brandon, stay tuned. We're going to come back and just get a final tip or two from you. This is the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB. Welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB. So I've got Brandon Turner on the line from BiggerPockets.com. It's a website you can go to for more information about investing in real estate, and they've got a huge forum with like a million comments and questions and all the rest. Brandon, what's your favorite story about the best property or the best deal you ever came across for investing?
Sure. So this one is not necessarily the best in terms of financials. It was a good one, but it's a fun story in that I bought a duplex, my very first duplex ever. I bought it fairly cheap. I actually lived in one of the units, rented the other one out, which was a good way to get started. And later on, I moved out. Anyway, I had the tenants in the front. It was two houses on one lot was what it was. And people in the front house kept telling me there was flashes in their window. They kept telling that over and over, there's flashes, and they didn't know what it was. I thought maybe the city was taking photos. Finally, we figured out what it was 3 years later when some Swedish tourists knocked on the door and wanted a tour of Kurt Cobain's first house. So we found out later that Kurt Cobain had actually been born, you know, his first house when he was 0 to a year old had lived in this house. So now it's kind of an interesting story. It's a cool thing to have that, but it's also cool knowing that every month I get cash flow off of it.
Yeah.
So it's both an investment and kind of a cool bragging story.
That is really cool. We should figure out how else to monetize it, like putting up a poster in the front yard of him or something, or some wood sculpture so that people can go and have their pictures taken. And Kurt Cobain lived here, a little sign, Kurt Cobain lived here. Thanks so much for joining us, Brandon. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been great.
A lot of good stories. BiggerPockets.com. BiggerPockets.com. Go there, learn about investing in real estate. Stay tuned. We've got another really interesting person for you to meet coming up next on the Elise Klink Show. Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB.
News 95.5 and AM 750, WSB.
Hey, welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Klink Show. Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB. This has been a really interesting show for me because we've talked about, with Bigger Pockets, investing in real estate. And then with Doorsteps, we have something very near and dear to my heart, first-time home buyers, right? And when you, and then we, of course, started with the economy with our Sternegy economics person. So we've kind of looked at where things are going and how first-time home buyers and investors can make the process a little easier. One of the problems, and I guess this ties back to what Lindsay was saying at the top of the show today, and if you didn't catch it, you can always listen online this week at iTunes or at thinklink.com. Just click on the podcast button. But the idea that housing prices are getting more and more expensive. And you think to yourself, well, we had such a big dive in housing prices. Have they really climbed so much that it makes a difference? Well, in Atlanta, there are places where housing prices went up 25-30% just last year alone. That kind of jump is completely unsustainable. Let me be really clear about that. That will eventually come to a crashing halt. But around the country, in other places, what we're seeing is that 34% of U.S. counties' housing markets are now less affordable for buying than their long-term averages, according to the latest report that was released on Thursday by Realty Track. It's their Q2 2014 affordability report. And every quarter, they go back and they look at what is the percentage of housing markets, county by county, and how affordable are those housing markets. And let me just tell you that if mortgage interest rates weren't at about 4% for a 30-year fixed and 3.25% for a 15-year fixed, which is really close to the 50-year long-term low, right? 50-year low. If we didn't have mortgage interest rates there, the number of housing markets which had become unaffordable, which are higher than their long-term averages, would be a lot higher than 34%. But let's just look at a third of all counties. The housing markets are unaffordable, less affordable than their long-term averages. So what does that actually mean, right? What does that mean to the average home buyer? Well, it means that they are less affordable than they've been for the past 14 years. That means those counties have swung all the way from their lows to all the way beyond their highs. It's like saying the stock market is up about 140% from its low March 9th of 2009. In 5 years, it's up 160%. That kind of growth rate is totally unsustainable, and the housing market is like that as well. So Realty Track went back and looked, and while none of the nearly 1,200 counties that are analyzed for the second quarter had regressed to a place that was dangerously unaffordable, so they're not even there, but you could be seeing an increasing bubble. And the scales, according to Realty Track, are starting to tip away from what they would call extremely favorable affordability climate, like one of the best in the last 2 years, with now we've got all these other counties that are just less affordable. But 81% of the population in the U.S. still lives in places where the percentage of income needed to purchase a median price home, median is sort of the halfway point, The same number of homes are sold above as below. So the median price is at or below its long-term average. But what's shifting is that the counties where you used to have 20% or less of median income needed to buy a median-priced home, those counties, it's going away. And you need more income to buy. And this is with mortgage interest rates at historical lows. So what happens when interest rates start to go up? And I know we talked about how this was going to happen before the end of 2014, and I don't think it is anymore. And as we discussed with Lindsay earlier in the show, when you see long-term interest rates and mortgage interest rates today, even though the 30-year are kind of based on a 10-year bond, when you see these long-term interest rates at 50-year historic lows or near 50-year historic lows, what it tells you is that the economy really isn't that strong, that the progress we've made is slow. I wouldn't even call it steady, and we're really, really late for what should be early in the recovery, right? We're 5 years out from technically the end. June 1st of 2009 was technically the end of the recession, the Great Recession. But here we are, 5 years plus later, and we haven't really improved all that much. What's happened is that, as we discussed in the first segment of the show today, more people are employed, but you're still missing like 10 million people who are out of the job force altogether. And you can see that in the labor participation rate. It's still pretty darn low. People who have gotten a job have most of the jobs that have been created are part-time. 60% of those are part-time jobs. You have a whole bunch of people who 50% of the jobs that have been created are at the lower end of the income spectrum. And you have a whole lot of people who'd rather be working full-time than part-time anyway. And so all of that combined with a whole new slew, a generation of millennials who have come out of college with huge amounts of debt, who have just decided that the sharing economy is better than the owning economy, and they're not even looking either. And so demand seems to be falling off or slackening. And so the fact that that is going on, I think the bond traders have realized it, even as the Fed is pulling back its mortgage-backed securities. And so bond traders are not really trading. Fed isn't inclined to raise the federal funds rate, which means that you're seeing this incredible lull and mortgage interest rates not going up. So what would happen if mortgage interest rates jumped up to 5% for a 30-year fixed, 1 point above where they are today? I think affordability would tank, because even though 5% is still a historically decent rate, for the last 20 years, mortgage interest rates have been under 6%, except for one, like, three-month period back in 1993. Oh, that's even beyond 20 years now. Wow. So we, in the last 20 years, haven't seen interest rates above 6%. It's a historical anomaly. And eventually, they're going to go up. So they go up to 5%. It's still below this 20-year historic rate, right? But it's a lot higher than it is today. It's 20% above where we are today. And that is going to cost people a lot of money. In fact, if you look at what people are actually spending for their mortgage payments, Zillow posted a blog post this week called How Much Waiting Could Cost You If You Wait, in other words, a year to buy a house instead of buying today. The expectation is that mortgage interest rates are going up. And with home prices continuing to go up and mortgage interest rates expected to increase 1 percentage point, home buyers in San Jose, San Francisco, Los Angeles, San Diego, and Riverside County, they said in their blog post, could all expect to pay an additional $300 to $700 a month more, with many, many more metro areas across the country paying an extra $150 a month if you were a home buyer. And that's by waiting. So the difference of a 1% interest rate, waiting a year, so a year from now the expectation is interest rates will be at 5% for a 30-year fix instead of the 4% roughly that it's at right now, could cost you $150 a month more to $700 a month more for just a typical home price, median cost of a home. And you can see that on Zillow. So when I think about it, I think to myself, what is this really telling me? And that's how I think about when I look at all these numbers every week and I think about what I'm going to tell you on the radio and how I'm going to frame this for you. I think about what it would cost me if I were a first-time home buyer or I were buying now. And what would the difference in price mean? And I look at my own neighborhood during the Great Recession. I live in a neighborhood where oftentimes it's just one person, usually the husband, big breadwinner, and the wife stays at home. What happened in the Great Recession is a lot of those husbands lost their jobs, right? And the sole breadwinner lost his or her job. And the family was foundering, and they wanted to continue to keep up appearances, so their credit card debt skyrocketed. And they ultimately ended up in foreclosure or bankruptcy, short sale, and we're still shedding a lot of those houses in my own neighborhood, which is a really nice neighborhood. What that's done is temporarily, for 4 or 5 years, lower the price of the homes. And we're also seeing fewer people who are moving into the neighborhoods. And we see that mostly in the number of kids per grade. There's just, we've gone from a typical 150 kid grade, which has been here for the whole 20 years I've lived here. And now the third graders only have about 90 kids in their grade. It's gone down by so much. And so families haven't been moving in, and they're talking about this lost generation in our neighborhood of kids who should be here and who aren't, and what that means for the tax base, what it means for schooling, what it means for what's going on with the other neighborhoods that feed into the bigger school district for high school. All of those things have an impact on the housing market, the taxes that get paid, how much money is there for services. And so when you see housing prices go up and you see mortgage interest rates supposed to be going up, they're going to go up on a dime. They could jump up a half a point in a week or two. We've seen that before. So you have to decide when you want to go buy a house. You have to decide when it's right for you. And you shouldn't buy before it's right for you, for sure. But with more homes and housing markets that are unaffordable, you've got to think about where you want to be in the next 3 to 5 years. And if you, where you want to be in the next 3 to 5 years is being a homeowner in your neighborhood of choice, the window for buying this is closing. All the really great deals I talked about back in 2007, 2008, 2009, 2010, 2011, most of those really amazing deals are gone. There's still a lot that are out there, but the price point is higher. So how much higher are you going to let it get? I don't know. That's up to you. But I suggest you think about buying in the next 6 months and making the most of what this seems to be a little slowdown that we've been having, this uneven, choppy, volatile recovery that Lindsay talked about, making that work for you. All right, stay tuned. We're going to come back with a couple more thoughts, a special offer for you. I'm Elise Glink, Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB.
News 95.5 and AM 750, WSB.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Glink Show, Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB. So we've talked a lot about the economy today. I want to remind you, go to thinkglink.com. Sign up for the free weekly newsletter. It comes out twice a week, including Thursdays, where we have Glinkonomics. All of it is free. We just want you to understand a little bit more about what you're doing with your money. And if there's a way that I can help, I'm happy to do it. One way I want to help is to give you access to the Intentional Investor Series, How to Be Wildly Successful in Real Estate. It's designed for really first-time investors, although I think there's something that almost anybody will take away. I'm offering it to you still for 75% off, three-quarters off. I really want you to take advantage of it. I think we heard earlier from the guy from Bigger Pockets that the biggest mistake people make is not being informed, not understanding the numbers, not even understanding what it's going to cost them to buy something at $170,000 versus $70,000. If you don't know what the costs are, if you don't know how to make them work, you really can't buy real estate successfully. So I want you to take advantage of the deals that are there, that are left, that the hedge funds haven't done, that the private equity guys have missed. Those are the deals I want you to have. Go to thinkglinkstore.com, thinkglinkstore.com. Use the code BUYNOW, B-U-Y-N-O-W, BUYNOW. It should give you 75% off. Would love for you to take advantage of the Intentional Investor, How to Be Wildly Successful in Real Estate. And if you're not already following me online, at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K. All right, well, that's all I know right now anyway. Stay tuned. We'll have another show for you again next week. I'm going to go off and enjoy this Sunday. I hope you do the same. In the meantime, check out the website, thinklink.com. Make sure you sign up for the free weekly newsletter and stay connected on Twitter at Glink. Have a great week, everybody.